Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Action Park Media.
You're listening to The Dossier, presented by Metro by T-Mobile. The night Biggie was murdered, Eugene Deal was working security for Sean Puffy Combs and Bad Boy Records. What Gene saw that night has made him one of the only eyewitnesses that identified the actual shooter of Biggie. His personal story and what he saw has never changed in 24 years. When FBI agent Phil Carson started his own investigation as it relates to the LAPD corruption surrounding the murder, he visited Gene. Inside this interview, Phil references FBI documents that I provided him via a FOIA request that has Gene's statement from 2004. This is the first time in close to 17 years that Phil and Gene have talked.
Hey, Gene, are you there?
I'm here.
Phil, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, Big Gene, how you doing?
Phil, what's going on, boy?
Not how too doing, much. Sir? Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks.
That's good, man. Put the retired papers in, huh?
What's that?
So you put those retired papers in, huh?
Yeah, I finally did. Yes, I. Yep. Mm-hmm. Right. Good feeling.
You know, I think for me, Gene, and I won't speak for Phil, but what I think is great about, like, you guys being on the phone is I think when you look at this story and all the people that are online, all the people that I think, Gene, like, you've been telling your story for years, Phil has now decided to tell his story. I think there's probably a lot of people out there that could make a case or have in the past that maybe you guys even never talked, and how this story and the truth of what, you know, happened has kind of been twisted in all of these different ways. And you know what I think would be great would be for you guys to talk about, you know, how, your interactions and when you met. And Phil, why it was important to you to talk to Gene, and for people to understand when you went out and set out to do your investigation. I can always remember you telling me, you know, I needed to go talk to Big Gene. I wanted to understand what he had been asked or shown or whatever. So maybe that's a good place to start is, you know, the story of how you guys met and what that meant.
Yeah. So I got Big Gene's phone number. I contacted him, told him who I was, the reason I wanted to come out to New York and talk with him about the events that happened the night that Biggie got shot. Gene gave me the address. He was working the night that I showed up at his work with another agent that flew out from LA with me. I just remember when I first saw Gene, I'm like, okay, I now understand why they call him Big Gene. You know, and trust me, I not only tried to do whatever due diligence I could on who Gene was, but I think he did a good job when he first saw me was, you know, he wanted to make sure, you know, I was who I said I was and that I didn't have any ulterior motives and, you know, that I was there really to try to get to the truth of the matter of what took place that night that Biggie was shot. And so myself and the other agent, we sat down at his office there and we talked, and it seemed like after, you know, a little feeling out period of, on both of our parts, you know, we both understood, you know, we just want the truth to get out there. And, we talked for a while and seemed to hit it off pretty good. And, you know, like I've said before, I find Gene not only 100% credible, but he was very forthcoming. He was very truthful. And, I don't understand why there's these people out there that even dispute that I was the FBI agent that either first opened up this case, or I wasn't even assigned to the case when a different agent went and interviewed Big Gene. Why people come up with these crazy narratives, it's laughable. It's a joke. And like I said, I found Gene 100% credible. I corroborated a lot of the things that he said with not only other people that were there at the scene, but some other things that I was able to do. And I thought that was important.
And Gene, you know, with Phil coming out over the last, I'd say, you know, 3 or 4 months and finally telling his story, what has that meant for all of the time that you spent talking on your YouTube channel, doing interviews? What was your reaction when you finally realized Phil was here and he was setting the record straight?
Well, you know, sometimes our people don't believe that an individual like myself could come out with as a witness and put everything on the line based on the powers that be. When Phil came to my office, you got to realize, you know, I kept his card. I kept every last one of the officers, even the LAPD officers, catching them. I kept their card. So I didn't just pull Phil Carson's name out the air when I said years ago that he was the individual that came and he, you know, I wouldn't say interrogated me, but, you know, he interviewed me. We did have to get to know each other because you have to understand, the LAPD told me they were coming back after I had seen that picture of me, Puff, and the Muslim, which we know as Amir Muhammad. They told me they were coming back, and I never heard nothing else from them at all. So me coming out here and giving the people as a witness the information that I saw, the things that I saw, the things that I heard, and Phil coming to collaborate and say, yeah, me and Gene did have that conversation. Me and Gene did do that. That's coming from an FBI agent. He don't have no reason, no rhyme or reason to lie for me. He's there to get the information, to get the truth, no matter where it lies. And for him to come out to be totally honest, when I first heard the dossier, yo, my heart dropped and I was so out, yo, I can't even tell you how happy I was, man. And I said that I'm gonna help push this, and I just hope some other people get on the bandwagon so it can get the notoriety that it needs, and then maybe, just maybe, Big can get his justice.
What I find interesting, Gene, is from the very first time that you've ever spoken about the events of that night, your story has never changed. You know, I think a lot of people in your position would have done what you could, spoke what you could, and then realized and sat back and said, this is insurmountable. I can't keep talking about this because nothing's being done. Why did you decide for so many years to develop a platform to talk to people, to educate people, to tell people these stories? Why did you feel that that was important?
Because when you don't tell the truth like Puffy did, he didn't tell the truth, that somewhat hurts the authenticity of what we went through. And people can't learn from a lie. You understand? So I said to myself, until he tells the truth of what happened, what was told to him prior to going to the party, I'm going to stay on his neck. Because he's wrong. Anybody else who has to go through something like that, or may go through something like that, and they don't listen to their bodyguard, don't listen to the person who's doing their security and everything like that, it may just happen like that again. So I took it upon myself to take my hammer and chop at the Empire State Building. And if I got to just get a little bit at a time, and one person know the truth, two people know the truth, we're going to be all right.
And Phil, what was your experience as it relates to getting information from Puffy or anyone in that regard? Did you end up interviewing him or not? What was your stance there?
Yeah, I actually had a lot of conversations with his attorneys, saying, you know, this is the reason I want to talk to him, and I might have some even information that I need to provide to Puffy to give him a little bit of more of a background of what really transpired that evening. And I got some pushback at first, and then finally we were able to set it up, and I went and talked to Puff, and he was very nice, very cordial. Didn't get much information out of him, I'll be honest with you. I could understand where he was coming from, but I didn't necessarily agree, just because from my research and the relationship that he had with Biggie, you know, one of his best friends and all that sort of stuff, he wasn't very forthcoming with information. And I think the reason why is at that time, you know, Puff was a mogul, but he was becoming even a bigger mogul. He had in all the different entertainment avenues that he was involved in, as well as the clothing line and everything like that. I think he realized that no matter what he said, he wasn't going to be able to bring Biggie back. And maybe he just felt that maybe the more he talked, or if he actually told the truth or what really happened and all that sort of stuff, that all that would do is put a target on his back. Because I know after the shooting occurred, he kind of had to, you know, hide out or hole up for a while, because, you know, he was in fear that, you know, maybe people were going to be coming after him, that that his life would be in danger. And very much so, I can understand that, because he was the intended target, is the bottom line. And when I actually told him that, that definitely got his attention.
But Phil, people don't look at this, that Puff is responsible for the safety of his artists. And if he tells the truth that, you know, he was told that it was going to be a hit, he was told that some guys were going to kill them, and he didn't do a due diligence to get enough security for his artists, then that makes him liable.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you. I 100% agree with you, Gene. Absolutely.
And that, like I told people 1,000 times, if I wouldn't have never took that DEA class, you know what I'm saying, that surveillance, and it was interrogation and surveillance class, and they taught us, you know, if you you want to know if somebody following you, run 3 lights, take 3 rights, you know what I'm saying, either or, you know what I'm saying. And I told our driver to run the next 3 lights.
Well, Gene, you told me that. I mean, I trust me, I documented that. You told me that, and that was one of the downfalls, was, you guys ran that first light, and then I'm trying to think of who was driving Biggie's car.
G-Money.
Okay, yeah, it was great. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
He didn't have any background in executive protection or security, so he sat at the light. And that created a sitting target, a stationary target for the shooter.
And so, what I was telling people, and they always say this wrong in every movie, they don't understand the car was parked at the corner.
Right.
Yeah. The car was parked at the corner. It was no drive by. What he did was when Big was stopped at the light, you know, he esked up from the parking space he had right there at the corner, took his shot, and then Kenny, our driver, when he heard the first shot, because Tone said somebody pointing a gun at Big now. I went to open my door, as I told you, and then we heard the first shot. Bow! Then Kenny just guns the car, then next thing you know, we hear bap, 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 bap. Then he turns the corner and he's gone. We get back in front of the car, everybody is gone. You know what I'm saying? Big is the only one in the car. We wait till they come back. And Tone said, Gene, come on, Gene. I hopped in our car that Kenny was driving, and we go after the guy. So my whole thing about it is that you're right. He didn't have any protection. G didn't have any knowledge of security. And that was whoever was responsible for Big security, which was Paul Offord and that Inglewood cop. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, let me add something that I think is important too, because there's some people out there that apparently are trying to push a different narrative. I'm looking at a copy of my interview with Eugene that was 17 years ago, okay? Everything that you just described right now that took place, detail by detail, is exactly what you told me 17 years ago. And why there are people out there that say that, whatever, you changed your story or this and that. I'm sick of hearing that from other people. You have been 100% honest from the beginning. You've always told the truth. Your story has never wavered. Everybody else that I talked to back then corroborated everything that you told me. And I don't understand why I do understand why these people are trying to push a false narrative, because they're just trying to stand behind their false story. But I don't understand why people would even spend 2 seconds listening or even acknowledging these false narratives why they try to say, oh, Big Gene isn't believable because he changed his story. I'm here to tell everybody you are believable. And I wish these other people that dispute that would just shut up and go away, because that's getting tired and old.
They're not going to do
seriously.
That.
No, they're not.
That's why they call them trolls.
Yeah. I have a question that I want some clarity on from both of your different perspectives. And it has to do with a particular photograph, I guess, Gene, that was shown to you. Phil, obviously we've talked so much, but I want to understand, there was a photograph, and in this photograph, Gene, as far as I understand it, you said to the LAPD, if you unblur this person's face in this photograph, that's who the shooter is. Is that correct? Talk me through the photo from your side, Gene, and then Phil, I want to hear your perspective on it.
Sure.
All right. First and foremost, they wasn't trying to show me that photo. All right. What had actually happened is that the tape that they were recording me on clicked off. But they had it under the cover. And they had photos and stuff like that under the cover. So now they're looking at each other like two buffoons, because they taping me without even letting me know that they were taping me. Right? I had my lawyer in there, Eloise Nurse. And she said, you taping my client without our permission? And then he tried to explain to Eloise that the reason they were doing it because they can't remember all the stuff that may have been said in the interview. So when they go and move the cover, these pictures are under the cover, right? And when he moved the cover, I see the picture is me, like on the side of a facial thing, is Amir Muhammad, is Diddy, we're going to say the Muslim, because I didn't know it was him at the time. The Muslim is Diddy right there in the photo. And I remember exactly what happened, because Phil, you know, I thought he was trying to get me, because he said, yo, did you have your gun on me? And then I said, yes. He said, what happened? I said, I showed him my weapon, and he walked down the street in the opposite direction. You know what I'm saying? So now, the LAPD, they wasn't trying to show me that picture. Then I seen the picture. I'm like, oh, shit. That's the guy right there, because I remember Little C said a Muslim had killed Big when we was at the hospital. And I said, the blue suit, white shirt, blue bow tie, peanut-looking head. He was like, yeah, how you know, Gene? Paul Offord said that. Yo, Gene, how you know? I said, he walked up to Puff car first. You understand? So, like, when we're not going to mention his name, but the A1 super cop from L.A. Said that I was in some kind of pissing contest with him. Didn't happen like that. He was coming close to my principal. He was coming close to my client. I showed him I lowered my gun from under my shirt. He looked at it and walked back in the opposite direction. You understand?
when the LAPD, you know, when I seen that picture, I said, oh shit, this the guy right here. And then they faked the guy, faked everything was clear in the picture. I was clear, Puff was clear, everything was clear in the picture except his face. Now, anybody who took photography 101, they know that you could take when you doing a picture, you could take a pencil and stuff like that. And if you don't want that to come, that person's face to come out, all you gotta do is go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth while you're doing the photo imaging. And I knew that because I had that class in college. So I knew what they had did. You understand what I'm saying?
Did you get any indication or ever see when they were showing you the murder book or any of that stuff of this photograph that Gene is talking about?
Yes, and it does exist because myself and the other agents saw it in the murder book. And that's when we went back to my bosses because we couldn't make any copies or take any pictures or anything like that. And we explained to my bosses what happened. And then we went back again to take a look at the murder book. And the pictures were gone. And it's pretty obvious. It's like I explained, you know, it's like if you have a photo album of like, you know, pictures from the third grade that your mom put together or something like that. And there's like four pictures on page and you keep flipping the pages. And then suddenly you see a couple blank spots where it was obvious pictures would have been. And those pictures are no longer there. And we noticed that. That's when my bosses, I wrote up a document. My bosses signed it. We sent it over to LAPD and to specifically Detective Katz, saying we not only want to see all the photos of your murder book, but specifically the photo that was shown Big Gene where he was standing next to who we believe is Amir Muhammad outside of Puffy's car when Big Gene brandished his gun, and that Amir Muhammad, who we believe was Amir Muhammad, that his face was blurred out. And they stated that that photo doesn't exist. I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me. We've seen it, guys. Come on. And to this day, I mean, they just denied that they had that photo. It's ridiculous.
He wasn't exactly next to me. He was about 7 feet or 8 feet.
Yeah,
Right. And he was a little bit further from Puff's car because I wasn't going to let him get that close. When they told me they was going to come back and I never heard from them, Phil, yo, I was scared as hell.
And here's the thing, Don. It's because, again, everything that Gene is saying right now is 100% true today. It's 100% true what he told me 17 years ago. And it's 100% true what he told the LAPD because the LAPD documented that. There's a copy of that document in the FBI files. Well, so for them to even deny that they even showed that photo, it's beyond embarrassing. It's just ridiculous. These things are documented. And like Big Gene was just saying, for, you know, A1 number LAPD detective to dispute this or to say that Gene had some eye-fucking contest with his Muslim and that's what caused the confrontation, no, it's not. That's the shooter. This isn't rocket science, guys.
I think the thing that and maybe both of you can give me your perspective on this, right? So just so I'm clear, Gene, and I know, you know, listen, I'll say his name. I know we all have our opinion. Did Greg Kading come to you as a detective and did he interview you?
Not at all.
Never?
Never.
And why?
Never once came to interview you?
No, he never came to interview me.
It's crazy.
And
absolutely
so
crazy.
How, Phil, as an investigator, you're an investigator, how does somebody be tasked to relook into the murder and there's an eyewitness who has existed for years? So he doesn't go and talk to the eyewitness. Then he makes a documentary film where he discounts what Gene has said to date, but he never went and talked to him. And secondarily to that, he investigated a case where he never had the files of all of this other stuff because the LAPD never gave it to him. yet he continually says these things in a public forum. I'm confused, and maybe you guys can explain this to me.
Don, it don't fit his narrative.
Exactly.
It doesn't fit his narrative. You know, if he interviews me and put that into a record, you understand, that exists. And then he has to account for that being in the record. And why didn't you account for eyewitness that put this guy at the scene? Why did you account for Little Steve saying right after shooting, it was a Muslim who did it? You know what I mean? So he doesn't, you know, the A grade one detective, you know what I'm saying? He did what he wanted to do, and he said it when he was talking to somebody on the show. After I cleared the thing for the LAPD, they had no use for me no more. They had no use for it.
I'm always traveling, always on the road, and the first thing I do whenever I get settled into a new city is I DoorDash items I know I can't live without. And it almost feels like home. Water, alcohol, a charger from my phone, snacks, food from delicious local restaurants, and breakfast in the morning, because you can't cook when you're living in a hotel. DoorDash, your door to more. So download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything from pet food to snacks to neck braces, alcohol, toothpaste, Joy-Con controllers for you gamers out there. Pretty much anything. You can get it. You must be 21 plus to order alcohol and drink responsibly. Alcohol is only available in select markets. DoorDash, go download it. Come on, get it done. Immerse yourself in the fascinating tale of Song of Solomon by the legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning author Toni Morrison, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that has captivated readers around the world. Follow the protagonist, Milkman Dead, who was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt at flight. For the rest of his life, Milkman 2 will be trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and himself in his Rust Belt hometown to the place of his family's origins, she introduces an entire cast of Shrivers and Cirruses, liars and assassins, the inhabitants of a fully realized black world. As the New Yorker put it, Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personality. Whether you're a seasoned reader or new to Toni Morrison, Song of Solomon is a must-read that will ignite your imagination and leave you wanting to read more Morrison. Song of Solomon, a timeless tale that will stay with you long after you've turned its final page. Available now at tonimorrison.com and wherever books are sold.
Hey, I got a question too, because I have not watched, and nor do I ever have any intention to, because it's just a fictional TV series, or as far as I'm concerned. But did Greg Kading ever interview G Money or Little C's or anything, anybody of those, any of the other guys that were right there in your entourage?
I can't answer that.
Yeah.
What I don't understand,
Don, is and again, I'm not in the the TV industry, but whoever the executives or the people that produce or are going to produce some type of TV series that's based on a true event, how can you not do your due diligence? So this isn't, I'm not saying this just isn't on Greg Kading, but who are the executives who need to do their due diligence and all their checks to verify that this stuff is either true or not true, or to actually corroborate things on their own? It's kind of like when you interviewed Brad Furman, the director of City of Lies, where he said, they went out and they had to do their due diligence and corroborated things and tracked people down. How did that not happen for this TV series, when the number one witness, Big Gene, was right there, and they never talked to him? It's mind blowing to me that they wouldn't follow up on something like that, and yet go ahead and produce a TV series or documentary and whatever, it's just not factually correct.
If you look at the series of events, what basically transpired is that up until you deciding to talk, Greg Kaden could get away with bad-mouthing Russ Poole, and there was nobody to support Russ Poole. I think you can make the argument that Randall Sullivan supported Russ Poole, but Randall Sullivan is a journalist, right? So then what you have is this massive lag in time that ultimately we then get to when you decide to finally tell a story. They can't attack your character. I think they could attack Russ Poole's character because at some point there was a narrative of, you know, the kind of like detective with the storage space who's gone off the deep end. They can't say that about you. You understand what I'm saying? First time in a period of 10 years, there's a narrative that you can't discredit, sadly, for Greg Kading. It's sad because he got away with and perpetrated a scam of Hollywood, a scam of whoever he did the documentary with, a scam of whoever he printed the book with. And so, unfortunately, it is what it is for us to land here today. And again, I challenge anyone to give an alternative narrative to what, you know, we've presented here in close to 20 episodes of the dossier of evidence of other people speaking, and more importantly, you going on the record. And obviously, we can go on for days about that.
I don't mean to cut you off, man, but I have to ask Phil, because if I don't ask Phil this, my friend Charlie out there in North Carolina, he's going to be so mad at me, man.
Still, okay.
You guys are the FBI. You guys couldn't get all those sealed records, all those things opened up through the courts or whatever like that, all that paperwork that they had. Y'all couldn't get that.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, here's the interesting part is, when the LAPD doesn't disclose that they have all those documents, and those documents are then hidden away in some files, we don't know what we don't know. And even to this day, who's to say what else is being hidden at the bottom of a drawer? And I'm not saying there is, but from what I understand, there's a likelihood. But then once those documents finally do come out, but they are under seal, we have no access to them. I hate to say it, but there's no way that we can get our hands on that. And here's the sad thing. And understand, I don't have anything against the LAPD. I have something against certain people at the LAPD. But I have a lot of friends that work there. I had a good working relationship with them. And unfortunately, there's always a couple bad apples that kind of, you know, ruin it for everybody. Because of the working relationship the FBI has with the LAPD, it's not like if I have to go to a company and I need to subpoena a bunch of records, we try to be, you know, do the professional courtesy and explain to them, hey, these are the kind of documents that we believe are out there. Can you provide those to us? And understand, from the very beginning, Gene, I put out an olive branch to that robbery homicide division and Steve Katz. I cannot tell you how many times I asked them if they wanted to be part of the FBI's investigation. We wanted to look into things together, and they didn't want anything to do with it after they took off the two detectives because they knew that they were going to have to ruin this case and obstruct it. Otherwise, it was going to be made. And so some of the things that I asked for, they would not provide, such as the photo of you and Amir outside the Peterson near Puffy's car. I mean, it's documented that photo exists. It's documented that me and another agent saw that photo. And it's documented that my bosses signed off on a letter specifically sent to certain people at LAPD, including Detective Katz, requesting that we see that photo. they respond, that photo does not exist. What do you do at that point? You got to just shake your head and just go, what the hell are we dealing with here? And it's not like we're just trying to say, hey, I gotcha, and slam the LAPD on something. It's, look, my boss has signed off and opened up this case. The FBI is doing their job. The FBI has reached out to the LAPD detectives to be part of this case, and they decide they don't want to be then. And so, you know, if they're not going to hand over these documents, you're kind of stuck. And again, some of the documents that I believe are out there that we've never seen, I don't know if we're ever going to see them unless somebody else decides to open up the case.
And I think, Gene, just to add to Phil, what you have to understand and is very important, and we're trying to get Perry Sanders to come and talk to us about questions like you just asked. Even, for example, with the civil trial, at a certain point, what the LAPD really did is they went to the federal judge and they said to the federal judge, hey, we have new information, and this is now an active murder investigation. Now, under that premise, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, the minute they tell the federal judge this is still an active murder investigation, that then allows them to control what Perry Sanders could see, what the Wallace family could see, what could be brought into court, and what could be buried in what Randall Sullivan likes to refer as to like a safety deposit box somewhere in downtown Los Angeles.
Correct. And the unfortunate, I guess it's both fortunate and unfortunate, is the fortunate thing is there is no statute of limitations on a murder. The unfortunate thing is because of that, the LAPD can say, hey, this is an ongoing investigation. We should not have to hand over this particular evidence or these particular leads because we're still investigating it. And if we do turn this stuff over, it's going to impede or hamper our investigation. And the judge bought off on that. So basically, they have an endless amount of time to hold on to these documents or to hide these documents from ever coming to light, which means, I mean, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, does that mean this is still going to be an open, ongoing murder investigation? Well, I guess so, if they're going to continue to hide those documents. That's the ridiculous thing about it.
Hey, Gene, what, after all this time, still surprises you about this story enough for you to still want to talk about it, for people's interest in it?
Well, the fact that there were eyewitnesses there. You know, Lucy saw the shooter. I put the shooter there at that position. I put the shooter there. Lucy, you know, be the guy who's taking the shots and everything. So for people to come up with this hoochie narrative and all this other bull crap, and they still believe that, when eyewitnesses, because when you're doing an investigation, the most important statement that is made is the statement that they make that night. It's the statement that they make right there at the scene. You know, and you have to go with that statement that is made, you know, when we're doing investigation. So when Lil C said it's a Muslim, and then I say blue suit, what you call like that, you run with that. So what happens is that, you know, how people, it used to be a story that I used to hear, people are ready to hear the bullshit more so than they do the truth. So, you know, how people are just coming on here and they running with the bullshit instead of listening to the truth. And it's good that Phil, who is a decorated FBI agent, you know what I'm saying? You know, he didn't have to come out. He could have kept quiet. You understand? But because he wasn't allowed to do his job just like Russell Poole, you understand? And he has the paperwork. He has the documentation. He has everything to put on the table to show you this is what we tried to do to find Big's killer.
And I wasn't allowed to do that. So what keeps me on and keeps me going is this, is that one day that something is going to hit, somebody's going to say something, and they're going to say, yo, listen to me. And it's going to, I think that Phil cleared me out there, but I want those people who was there to come out and say, yo, Gene was right. Gene told us at Andre Harrell house that guys is coming to kill us. You understand? Lucille just said something lightly like that, but you know, his words don't hold no weight. But a couple of people are gonna come out and they're gonna tell the truth. And I wait on that.
And Phil, I do have a question for you that I don't think I've ever asked you. And what would be preventing the LAPD to charge, if the evidence was there, the alleged shooter in Amir Muhammad and not, I guess, include the Mac or the Perez or how it all came about? What would the fear be if that was to happen, then Amir ultimately goes on the record of how it all was put together? What would prevent him from just making an arrest?
Well, the one thing is there is, and this is everybody that's ever looked at this case has always said the same thing. There is no way in hell one person pulled this off, period. And without question, that's correct. In fact, there were two, I mean, Gene even told me there were two cars set up. So depending on which way the caravan that had Puff and Iggy in it, whichever way they turned, there was going to be a car that was going to be there that had a shooter that was going to be able to take out, you know, whether it be Puff or whether it be Biggie. So right there, it tells you there was more than one shooter. But there is no way one person is going to be able to lie wait in a car and not have other people involved to make sure that police officers don't. I mean, understand too, and correct me if I'm wrong, Gene, after Big was shot and you guys take off and try to follow the shooter, you know, going over 100 miles an hour on the freeway, lose them, and then you come back, there's still no police officers there yet. And you guys decide, oh, you know what, let's take them to Cedars-Sinai. I know you guys knew how to get there. Where are the police officers? And I'm not pointing the finger at LAPD here. I'm pointing the finger at anybody who was handling the security for the actual museum. There had to be police officers there. There's no way in hell you are going to have that level of celebrities, both athletes that were there, entertainers that were there. I mean, there were so many celebrities there that they're not only going to have their personal security, which is a lot of times off-duty officers, but you're also going to have security there that's supplied for the Peterson, as well as when you have a big event like that in a big city like whatever, Los Angeles, New York, wherever, you are going to have a ton of police officers, both uniformed to deter people from doing anything, as well as, say, in suits to where they can almost, like, you know, fit in with the crowd, be undercover, or, you know, be like the personal bodyguard for somebody, kind of like what Big Gene was. But to have no police officers show up there goes to tell you there had to be a concerted effort by more than just the shooter to try to orchestrate this. And that's where people need to understand how the Rampart case worked, how the Palmeros case worked, how the David Mack bank robbery worked. There were multiple people, multiple officers, radios were used, tactics were used, cars were used to be able to orchestrate those crimes, just like it was orchestrated to create the shooting of Biggie. And one person could not do it. So even though if you were to arrest the shooter, if you want to say Amir Muhammad, there's still so many other people. And if you're going to go ahead and arrest one person, that person's going to start talking. They're not going to take the fall for everyone. Guaranteed.
And Gene, that night when it all happened, obviously the adrenaline and you're doing what you're doing. When you think back on it now, was it odd to you that at that event or when this transpired that there was just absolutely no police that, as you said, they stopped the car, they got out, they were standing there, they were yelling, that no officers responded at all?
When we got back to the scene, see, you know, when you watch the television or L.A., even in L.A., you always see that when there's a shooting, there's a situation, the helicopters will be in the air. You know what I'm saying? There were no helicopters in the air. There were no police on our side of the venue. What I heard was is that somebody had did a shooting on the other side of the venue. You understand? And there were ambulances and there were police all over there. Nobody ever came back to that side. We didn't do 100 because we had that government chip car, Phil. And every time we tried to get up to 100, it would go all the way back down to 90.
Gotcha.
So we was never going to catch it. And then when we got back, police still wasn't there. I walked down to the in the middle of the Peterson, and that's when I heard DJ Quick. He said, "Yo," he was on the cell phone. "Yo, I think they got some one of them bad boy niggas. They said they was going to get him." And then I'm walking towards him, and Paul runs down. Says, "Yo, Gene, come on, we leave it. We take him back to the hospital." And he's grabbing at me. And I said, okay. So we go back up to the, I go back up to the car. And Kenny said, they asked Kenny, "You know where the hospital is?" He said, "Yeah." We didn't know it was a hospital like two blocks away. You know, and then when Lil Steve said that Kenny was dodging through, you know, traffic and everything like that now, and was flying and stuff like that, he was trying to go as fast as he could. But our driver was cursing and said, "I wish I knew where the hospital was, because Kenny was going too slow." You know what I'm saying? We didn't even know where the hospital was at. And it seemed like Kenny didn't know where the hospital was at.
In closing here, Gene, is there any questions, and you can ask as many as you want, of Phil, of his sort of investigation, or things that you've been wondering that you haven't had answers for, that maybe he can bring some clarity to? And Phil, I pose that to you too. Do you have any questions for Gene as it relates to anything we didn't talk about?
Well, I would like to ask Phil that, is it true that, because this has been said, that because of Big status and what it would cripple the city, him being a gangster rapper and everything like that, that there were forces that wouldn't allow them to get to the truth that was played?
What I can say to that is, and I stated it, you know, earlier on, is I was contacted by one of the attorneys for the city of Los Angeles. And they told me, it was at the end of a day, and they said, "Hey, we need to talk with you because you've been put on a witness list by Perry Sanders, and we cannot have you testify." And I'm like, "I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't know about any witness list or anything like that." And they said, "Well, yeah, prior to the trial starting, one of the requirements is all the attorneys, they have to, both on the plaintiff and defendant side, you know, they have to provide a witness list. And Perry Sanders provided you as one of the witnesses they plan on calling, and we cannot have you testify." And I'm like, "This is the first I've heard of it." They go, "Well, we need to talk to your bosses." And I said, "Okay, when do you want to meet?" They go, "We'll be at your office tomorrow morning." Well, that's, first of all, they don't usually come to the FBI office. And to do it that quickly, it was obviously a big deal. So I go ahead and I set up a meeting. I had all my bosses there. And that's where, and it's documented, like I stated before, point blank, they say, if Agent Carson were to testify, we stand a 50-50 chance of losing a $500 million or $600 million civil lawsuit, and we can't afford to have that happen. And the FBI said, okay. And the FBI didn't make it any determination at that point, but the case never went to trial, so it kind of got left at that. But just the fact that the city attorney's office was trying to squash me testifying and some of the other things that the city attorney's office tried to do to discredit me by making up these false narratives and false ruses that ended up getting the lead city attorney on this case fired and taken off the case because he was going to get sued by me and the FBI. He gets yanked off because he even admitted under oath that the reason they did some of the things that they did was to try to where they could discredit me if I were to be on the witness stand, saying that, you know what, he didn't follow through on certain investigative lead because we tried to get him to do certain things and they were going to try to use that to discredit me. They even admitted under oath that they made up those false lies and it cost the lead city attorney his job on the case. So, you know, it's they had a lot at stake. I mean, there's no doubt about it. This would have, and again, Gene, this is coming after the whole consent decree from the Rampart situation. I mean, that case, what did it cost them? Like $100 million that they ended up paying out and paying off all the people that got prosecuted that involved Rafael Perez's testimony. Once he was a disgraced officer, they pretty much had to let all those people go, let them walk free, and then they also had to pay off a bunch of civil suits because of that. So if that is going to cost them $100 million, their number was this was going to cost them $500 to $600 million. That's not my number. That's what they told us.
Well, Phil, I want to personally thank you, man, and I appreciate what you've done, man. You made my life so much easier as far as coming out and letting people know that I stood as a man and I fought this battle and I was fighting this battle by myself. I was letting everybody know, no matter what and no matter who, what I saw and what I witnessed that night. And I truly appreciate you coming out, man, and letting the public know that I was a man of my word and I was true to my word.
No problem. I mean, you know what? Sometimes the truth hurts people. But, you know, what's been told in this story, you know, by you and by me, it's the truth. It just is what it is. It was true 20 years ago. It's true today. And it's going to be true 20 years from now as well. So, you know what? It is what it is.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, guys. This was amazing to have you both on the phone at the same time. If there's any other follow-up, I'll get in touch with both of you, all right? Thank you.
All right, man. Good talking with you again, Gene.
All right. Take care. Phil, be good, bro. Peace.
You too, man.
The truth hurts, but in this particular case, the truth has been lost in 24 years of lies. In trying to make the definitive account of why the LAPD was able to cover up the murder of Biggie, I've tried almost everything to understand what happened. But I have two more people on my list to talk to who I think know exactly what happened. And that is David Mack and Rafael Perez.
Are you there?
I'm here.
So are you 100% correct that these are the phone numbers for David Mack and for Rafael Perez?
Yes, that's them.